it's in the breaking, we come unbound. And it's in the giving, we are found. Yeah, you can barely change.
Welcome to A Medicinal Mind, Wisdom and Well-Being. A podcast dedicated to the telling of authentic stories and the sharing of insightful wisdom, exploring science and spirituality, medicine and Mother Nature. No topic is off limits when it comes to growing our personal understanding and supporting our collective well-being. With your host, Dr. Rob Abbott, a family medicine resident practicing spiritually focused and evolutionarily informed functional medicine, we hope to nourish your being so that you can flourish in whatever the moment has called for you to do.
And I know you tried.
In episode 23 of A Medicinal Mind, Wisdom and Well-Being, I plunge headfirst into the world of inorganic chemistry, minerals, and metals with a man known affectionately as the Magnesium Man, Morley Robbins. Morley is one of the foremost experts on magnesium's role in the body, as well as the delicate dance that this conductor of the orchestra of minerals plays with calcium. Morley has also fervently explored the body's dynamic regulation of copper and iron, and its relation to multiple chronic disease states. Today's conversation is one not meant for a single listening, but rather for a series of inquiries as we collectively open to the mysteries of human mineral metabolism. Digging in quickly, we explore some basics behind metal and mineral metabolism. Who are the main players? What is magnesium responsible for in the first place? How about iron and copper? As Morley sheds light on the intricate regulation of these minerals, we begin to uncover the all-too-frequent scenario of chronic inflammation and increasing oxidative stress, and its relation to relative iron overload, as well as copper and magnesium deficiency. Getting a little gritty, we begin to ask some interesting questions. What are the implications of the modern lifestyle on magnesium metabolism and overall health? Is iron overload and the associated oxidative burden more common than we originally thought? And does this iron overload pose a greater threat to health than is currently espoused? Is iron fortification really helping us? And what in the world is copper deficiency anemia? I really hope you take the time to listen to this podcast, possibly in bite-sized chunks or on a couple different occasions, to really tackle some of the ideas and concepts presented by Morley and myself. As you will hear in the episode, I am already planning to have Morley back on the show to get even more into the weeds of mineral metabolism and human health. I encourage you to check out the links on our podcast page, as well as to read more about Morley's work and some of his additional discussions on this topic regarding magnesium, iron, and copper metabolism. We thank you guys, as always, for tuning in and appreciate your support. As we move into the fall season, we express our gratitude for your presence and for your choice to spend some of your precious moments here with us. We really hope you enjoy the show. Well, Morley, thank you so much for joining me today on this podcast.
Happy to do it. Glad to be here and really looking forward to our exchange.
So we can, you know, I'll give you a few minutes here in the beginning to introduce yourself and let this audience know a little bit about you. But then I'm thinking we just get right to the nitty gritty details of what this conversation is all about. What do you say?
Yeah, that's perfect. I like that.
So Morley, give everyone a little background into why we're here and how you came to kind of discover something that perhaps is not common knowledge.
Okay. Well, I affectionately refer to myself as a pre-med retread. had designs of going to medical school, grew up in a very sickly family, and spent a lot of time in hospitals dealing with doctors. I wasn't sick, but everyone around me seemed to be. So it seemed like the natural thing to do. My sister was a nurse. So I go off to college not knowing that there's a lot of work involved in becoming a doctor. So I said, screw that.
Just a little bit, every now and then.
Yeah, right. So I didn't have the academic discipline, but I still went ahead and applied, didn't get in. But if you don't get into medical school, you do the next best thing, and you go into hospital management. So if you can't be a doctor, you bust them around. So that's what I did for 12 years, and then did hospital consulting for 20 years, and was really good at connecting dots, doing forecasts, helping organizations grow. And then I had an epiphany over a frozen shoulder about 9 years ago. I couldn't pick my hand up above my waist. I was miserably uncomfortable. I couldn't sleep. And that led me to discovering my now wife, who's a chiropractor, because I knew that chiropractors were witch doctors prior to this event.
Of course they are.
Of course they are. Right? But prior to that encounter, I knew that a yardstick of healing, 35 inches was gifted MDs that knew what they were doing, and 1 inch was a bunch of wackos. And then after that encounter with Dr. Liz, and I got my full use and motility of my shoulder joint back within 2 weeks, I discovered that the yardstick flipped, and I realized that there are 35 inches of gifted natural healers, and 1 inch is a bunch of bozos, call them themselves MDs. And in that process, I realized that I wanted to become a wellness coach. I had done a forecast for some clients in North Carolina. This was back in 2008, that wanted to know what the demand for chronic care was going to be in 2025. And I got together a group of people and we did a forecast, and it was frightening because on every disease index, it was a hockey stick. And what I think is important to understand is that just after the Second World War, the United States was the healthiest nation on the planet, with 4% of people having chronic disease. And in 70 years, we are now the sickest nation on the planet, where over 50% of people have chronic disease. And I won't bore you with the statistics because you know them better than I do. But basically, the health of America has fallen apart. It's an absolute shadow of its former self. And I was aware of all this, and I said, I can't stay on the sidelines. And so I took a course in how to become a wellness coach. And then I took a second course, and then finally decided to dip my toe in the water. And I ended up actually working for Dr. Liz as her Girl Friday, of all things. But I was reading all the while. And over the last 9 years, I've spent 2 to 3 hours every morning at Starbucks reading 7 days a week. And I've read thousands of articles now. And I have become a self-taught mineral expert. And as you probably know, I focus on three minerals. I focus on the need for more magnesium, more bioavailable copper, and I'm sure we'll talk more about that. And we need less iron, which I think people who are listening to this are going to say, less iron? I'm anemic. And what we'll talk about as we have this conversation is the complete and utter confusion and deception about what anemia really means. But I think the biggest discovery that I've come across in the last 9 years is that it's iron overload that's killing us. And it's a global issue. This isn't just an American issue. They are adding iron filings to food all over the planet. They're adding iron oxide to medications all over the planet. And they are creating a state of anemia that is deceptive, because they're not measuring iron in the tissue, and they're not measuring the ferrooxidase enzyme, which is absolutely essential to move iron from tissue to blood and back again. And so people are being poisoned with iron supplements, iron infusions, and just it's out of control. So that's my big aha over the last 9 years.
Wow. And I mean, I'm so impressed with your dedication. I mean, hearing your routine every morning, willing and being curious to continue to read, to grow. I'm sure, you know, reading one morning and then the next morning seeing that was completely false, or and being open to new ideas. I find that, fascinating, and just having that curiosity. So thank you for those efforts and for, you know, day in, day out, making that habit to want to grow your knowledge and share it with a massive audience. You know, I think I came across you just recently. A friend of mine pointed me towards the magnesium sort of advocacy group, and at the same time happened to hear a podcast with the Lyme Ninja folks. I listened to that about 2 or 3 times, and so much, you know, knowledge there. And we'll, you know, probably have a link to that in addition, you know, on the page for this, so people can, you know, go even deeper. Really was just impressed with the sort of, you know, the details that you have elucidated through your research as they relate to mineral metabolism. And I'll sit here and say, yes, I have MD after my name, and we have quite a bit of pathology and physiology in our training. Some of it is in the context of, I need to learn this and memorize this for one test, and then when that test is over, I can move on with my life and forget this, you know, nonsense that seems to be irrelevant. I have since kind of, you know, in going through this and taking biochemistry now about 3 or 4 times and going through my own self-study, now look back and see all these amazing interconnections between this physiology and how it's actually clinically relevant. And, you know, I only have about, you know, a few months worth of time delving into some of these topics. Well, you have 9 years. And so I want to have you kind of share with the audience this, this amazing relationship between, you know, in this case, we're talking kind of focusing on three minerals, but even this grander scheme of interactions in the entire body and how they're impacting our health. And I guess I'll just say before I let you go, you know, my framework for trying to understand, you know, minerals and the relationship in the body is kind of understanding a paradigm of, it starts with ingestion. And I think of, you know, you can ingest it through food, it can be absorbed through the skin. You know, it has to get into the body in some way. And then secondarily, there's absorption. So when you eat something, it has to be absorbed through some form of channel, some mechanism to get into the bloodstream. Then there's transport. So we have to have transport from the blood into the cell, or from the cell into the blood, you know, transport in some form through the body. Usually this is done with chaperones because, I mean, heck, we don't want just stuff going around willy-nilly. So we usually have certain proteins, and if something's a fat, it won't necessarily do very well in, you know, water-based blood. So we have to have some kind of transport mechanism. And then, you know, beyond that, we need a way to store it. So if we're thinking these things are relatively hard to acquire, or we want to have some degree of regulation, we need a place to store them. And then if they're stored, we also want to have an ability to utilize them or metabolize them when needed. So if we're regulating how we're, you know, getting them in, we want to be able to use them in the proper situation. So utilizing and metabolizing. And then lastly, I think of excretion. You know, how do we get rid of the mineral when it's maybe no longer useful or it's in a state of excess? And so I think of this is my kind of overarching framework for when we get to the nitty-gritty of, you know, these minerals, of how they're, you know, brought into the body, utilized, and excreted. You know, all of these things are important to understand when you're looking at mineral metabolism. And you can't just isolate into one of these and think you understand the whole idea, because it's so much more complex. So I wanted to at least give that out there so, you know, listeners can sort of see this framework, and then, you know, how it relates to what you're going to lead us into, as it relates to our three minerals of choice: magnesium, iron, and copper.
No, I think it's a great framework, Rob. What I've done is I've tried to boil this down so that the average person can really understand this. You know, I'm a really simple guy. I use my thumb to measure an inch. You know, and so I don't get out of my micrometer to measure an inch. I just like I eyeball it and say, okay, it's close enough. And I think that that symbol is what's needed to simplify nutrition, and I think ultimately to simplify medicine. I think it's become what we've created is a class of astronauts, and all we really need are bus drivers.
Analogy.
Yeah, it's gotten really blown out of proportion, and everybody's a subspecialist. And well, I just work on left index fingers, and you're like, what, huh? Are you serious? But that's happening. And the thing is, there are about 9,000 enzymes that run the body, and they all work just like the car you drive. So let me ask you a question. When was the last time you drove a car without a key?
Ooh.
It's hard to do.
I haven't done that recently.
Right? Unless you're Fred Flintstone, right? Right. And so the thing is, these enzymes work the same way, and minerals are the keys. They're what turn the enzyme on, and it turns out there are only a handful of minerals that run these 9,000 enzymes, and those minerals are lost to stress, easily lost to stress, and the top of the pecking order is magnesium. So let's just focus on that for just a minute, because if you read any article in the lay literature or the scientific literature, they love to tell you that magnesium is responsible for 300 enzymes. They always say 300 enzymes.
Wikipedia says that.
Yeah, well, it's actually, and you'll see it in every scientific article as well. It's always 300 enzymes. So I was really, I'm a curious George. I wanted to find out, where did that 300 come from? Well, it turns out there was a very distinguished professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School back in the 50s who loved magnesium. His name was Bert Valle, really big guy at Harvard. And someone was interviewing him once, and they asked him, Dr. Valle, how many enzymes does magnesium run? And he says, I don't know, it's about 300. Well, let's fast forward from the 1950s to 2012. And there's research that was done recently, in the last 5 years, where they discovered what's called the magnesome.
Gotcha.
And discovered that there are 3,751 enzymes that don't work unless magnesium's hanging around. Well, that's a big difference between 300 and 3,700. And that's the kind of distortion of reality that dominates traditional medicine. The way I characterize it is the locomotive of allopathic medicine runs on two rails. One rail is magnesium deficiency, and the other rail is iron toxicity. And just like any railroad track you've ever seen, those rails never touch, but they're bolted together. And that, what's fascinating about that is that when you get into the literature, as I have, deep, 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 I've gone from 1910 all the way up to the present day. I've read articles all over the map, all over the world, and there's a complete suppression of truth about magnesium and a complete cover-up about what really is the story with iron. So let me dig into that iron thing for just a little bit, just to give the listener something to chew on. Most people have heard of Otto Warburg, distinguished physician scientist that won the Nobel Prize in 1931. Very few people know what he really got the Nobel Prize for. It was for discovering the respiratory enzyme in the mitochondria, which we know as complex 4 today. It's a big deal.
Yeah.
He's a real smart guy. Well, in 1927, he's hanging out with his protege, Hans Adolf Krebs. You talked about the Krebs cycle earlier. Well, Krebs worked for Warburg in his lab in Berlin. And in 1927, they were obsessed with two metals in the blood. They were called iron and copper, because they wanted to find out what their relationship was to iron and copper. And so they bled birds to the point of near death to create a true state of anemia. It's the only state of anemia that I know of in any scientific study. All of them, all the others are artificial, but this was true anemia because they bled the birds almost to the point of death. And then they measured what happened inside the blood in response to that. What would you guess happened when these poor birds had virtually no iron left in their body, or in their blood at least? Any idea?
I think they would have actually done okay, because, you know, from an oxidative stress standpoint, it probably would have been better off.
Yeah, that's a good insight. Well, what surprised Otto Warburg and Hans Krebs is that there was a six-fold increase in copper proteins in the blood. And why is that significant? Because there is no iron metabolism and there is no copper metabolism, but there is copper iron metabolism, and it turns out it's a ventriloquist act, and iron is the dummy. And in fact, every facet of blood metabolism is copper dependent. So you can't make a heme molecule without bioavailable copper.
Without copper, yeah.
You can't insert iron into the center of heme. It requires an enzyme called ferrochelatase. Well, ferrochelatase is dependent on bioavailable copper. You can't knit four heme together to make hemoglobin unless you have bioavailable copper. And the enzyme that regulates the lifespan of hemoglobin is called heme oxygenase 1, and it keys off of bioavailable copper. And so what happens is that's the expression that was coined by Lao Tzu back in 600 BC was, people would rather believe the simple lie than the complex truth. Well, the simple lie is, you're anemic, take some iron. The complex truth is finding out that all of these facets of blood metabolism, and I could wear you out with what I've learned, are all copper dependent. And then we have the fact that all antioxidant enzymes, like ferrooxidase, superoxide dismutase 1 and 3, catalase, glutathione peroxidase, they're all dependent on bioavailable copper.
Yeah.
And so it turns out, this is the key for the listeners to really understand what's going on, is a very important iron researcher, his name is Robert Crichton, and he's based in Belgium. Brilliant mind. All the definitive textbooks on iron are written by Robert Crichton. And he wrote a really important article with a colleague of his, Pierre, Dr. Pierre. And this was in 2000. And it's called Old Iron, New Copper, Mars to Venus. And you're like, that's a pretty provocative title.
I might read that.
Yeah, you definitely should. You're in for a great treat. But what he points out is that Earth did not have oxygen for many millions of years.
Correct.
And then about a billion years ago, oxygen started to appear on the planet. And before oxygen came on the planet, everything was copacetic with iron. It turns out that 36% of the Earth's composition is iron. We're always told, well, it's the fourth element on the crust, but they never want to tell you that it's actually the number one element on the planet, because it's 36% of the composition of the Earth. And everything was fine as long as there was no oxygen. When oxygen came on the scene, iron was highly reactive to it, obviously, and the planet needed to find a metal to enable it to work with the oxygen. You think about the consciousness of the Earth trying to ensure that life could sustain itself, and it had to find a metal. It's like, it's mind-boggling the way he describes it. And guess where the metal was? It's called Venus, and that's where copper is. So you have Mars is red, iron. Venus is kind of this greenish blue. That's copper. Yeah. And so here's the deal. The only metal that can cleanly work and activate the dioxygen molecule is called copper. And that's the basis of all multi-copper oxidases. All those oxidases are copper dependent. Anytime you see the word oxidase or oxygenase, you know it's working with copper. but it's very, very carefully suppressed in the literature. And what they want you to believe is that because iron is carrying oxygen in hemoglobin, that's where 70% of the iron in the body is in a transport medium called hemoglobin. It's carrying oxygen. And it's like, okay, that's 70%. Less than 10% is this storage protein called ferritin that everybody's like completely obsessed with now. Mm-hmm. And the thing is, think of it this way. Iron is a waiter. It's carrying oxygen. Copper is the chef back in the kitchen, knows exactly what to do with it, so it can become energy. That's what copper is able to do, is turn that oxygen into energy, because it can cleanly add 4 electrons to it, to the oxygen molecule, and release 3 ADP in the respiratory enzyme. Thank you, Otto Warburg. So it can go over to complex 5, where the rotor is spinning at 9,000 revolutions per minute. Your car redlines at 6,000. And it adds magnesium to the ADP and a phosphate, and it becomes what's called magnesium ATP, and that's the energy molecule.
The energy currency of the body.
Right. But in any textbook that you've ever read, Rob, they never talked about magnesium. They talked about ATP.
Just ATP. Wink,
wink. Yeah, you're supposed to wink, wink, know that. Wink, wink.
Yeah.
And that's the elegance of copper and magnesium and iron, is that you can't make energy if you don't have bioavailable copper and magnesium. And you can't make, you got to have that oxygen. So that, yeah, it's important that the iron carried it there. But you don't give a Nobel Prize to iron because it carried it there. You give it because it knows how to work with it cleanly, like a chef does. And the whole obsession of medicine around iron is goofy. It's unbelievable. All they see is iron. They don't see magnesium. They don't see copper. And most people have never heard the word magnesium. And if they've heard copper, they know copper toxicity. Mm. They don't know that. And they don't know that.
Like Wilson's disease or, yeah.
Right. And as soon as you say copper toxicity, what you need to do is pull the curtain all the way back to reveal the iron toxicity that's causing it. Yeah. Wilson's disease is an iron disorder. It's not a copper disorder. That's a whole scam. The iron kills the transport proteins in the cell to transport copper. That's an iron problem. It's not a copper problem. Absolutely iron.
Yeah, this is such a miraculous symphony, and thank you for getting us started here and for bridging and making all of these connections that, I'm sitting here just like checking off in my head, yes, 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 this makes so much sense. And, I think the first seed probably got planted in my head probably about a year ago. I'm good friends with Chris Masterjohn. I was up in New York, and this great biochemist, and he was, I think, the first person who planted the seed of this concept of copper deficiency anemia. And anyone who's medicine here is probably hearing like, what are you talking about? Copper deficiency anemia? You're like making things up now. And as you've just described, actually, yes, copper deficiency anemia, when you understand that copper has this incredible need, or has this role in making the heme molecule, and as we've just described, what do you need in order to make hemoglobin? You need to make heme and then bonded to the globins, and so the deficiency more often than not is not the lack of iron, but the lack of, like you just said, bioavailable copper, allowing the body to actually make the heme that's necessary to make the hemoglobin. And I think when I heard that, and I went back and looked, and sure enough, when you look at the steps of making heme, and there's lots of, it's like a 10-step process, all these intricate enzymes, and as you just laid out, when you look at it, you're like, holy crap, there's copper, there's copper. And it starts to click in your head, this is, this makes so much sense. And, we go back to this concept too of like bioavailability. And I start to think of, so you mentioned, you've talked about iron, and how in traditional medicine we're measuring iron status. When we look at the blood, we measure serum iron, We measure different markers of its storage. So, you know, we can look at ferritin. We can look at, you know, total iron binding capacity. And, you know, but more often than not, people, you know, when we look at ferritin, the most common thing that comes up is, oh, that's an acute phase reactant. That's something that gets elevated in a state of acute inflammation. And so what I come to realize and I tell people, well, usually when you're doing blood work on individuals, especially in the hospital, why are they there? They're in the hospital because they're sick. They're inflamed. And so almost every time you measure one of these levels on someone who has some degree of inflammation, who's somewhat sick, there's usually an elevated ferritin. But what people then automatically say is, oh, well, that's just because it's acute phase reactant. And so they never actually go back, if they ever get to a state of balance, to say, well, maybe we shouldn't just say that was it was elevated because it was, you know, acute phase reactant due to inflammation. Maybe it was actually elevated because it was truly elevated. There was, you know, an elevated amount of iron being stored, and bioavailability of the iron, which we measure as, you know, the serum levels and these other levels, is actually low. And so we get misinformed to think that, oh, this serum level is low and we need to supplement, when actually what's dysregulated is the storage, transport, and utilization. You know, we got to think about everything. It's like, you know, you think about a circle holding hands, everyone's sharing, you know, passing plates of food, you know, sharing, you know, holding hands together. It's that's the problem. It's not that there's no food on the table. It's that it's in the wrong hands. It's in the wrong, you know, in the wrong compartment. And what we do in medicine is we just try to fix that by shoving more things and hoping the body figures out how to put it in the right compartment. And unfortunately, in states of, you know, dysfunction, disease, that doesn't happen properly. So I've come to try to open my mind to see, you know, bringing this to a degree of relevance. So people might be listening and saying, well, I'm, you know, I feel pretty well, or I've been sick. Where would I even start with this? Like, can I go get a lab test that tells me about iron or tells me about copper? Like, how do I know I'm magnesium depleted? Or how do I know I have too much iron? Does my doctor know about this? So lots of questions there. Perhaps you have some insights on where people could start.
Sure. And I will definitely answer that question. Let me just seal the deal on this whole thing about ferritin, because it's a great source of confusion. Then I'll talk about the testing that they can do. There's an elegant recycling program in the human body that recycles iron. I call it the recycling program. Its official name is reticuloendothelial system, which is like, what the heck is that? It's recycling is what it is. And so a lot of confusion about ferritin. So I decided to track down the world's authority on ferritin. His name is Sir Douglas Kell, a distinguished professor at the University of Manchester. And in 2009, he wrote a very important article called Blood Behaving Badly. It's actually Iron Behaving Badly. And then he wrote in 2014 another article called Proteins Behaving Badly. But to give you an idea of how thorough he is, usually when an author wants to make a statement in a scientific article, they might have 100 to 150 footnotes. That's a very robust article that has rigor and depth to it. In Dr. Kale's 24-page article, he has 2,400 citations. So basically what he's telling the scientific and clinical community, you're not just wrong about ferritin, you're dead wrong. And when I was talking to him on Skype a couple months ago, I asked him point blank. I said, Dr. Kell, what is the ideal ferritin for a human being? And he's my age, and he's got this wall of books behind him, very affable looking guy, and he looks me in the eye and he says, zero. And I thought at first he was kidding. I said, oh my gosh, do you realize you're in violent opposition to every practitioner on the planet?
Pretty much everyone else on the planet.
and he smiled. And he said, Morley, I want to make sure you understand this. He said, the ferritin protein is not synthesized in the blood. It is secreted into the blood. It is secreted into the blood because of liver pathophysiology. He said, so that when it's elevated, it's a sign that the liver is diseased. Is that clear? I said, perfectly. And what I've gone on to understand is that acute phase reactant side, which you were talking about, Rob, but there's another side to it. Most people are struggling with low ferritin. They're trying to figure out, why is it in the teens? Why is it in the single digits? And what that is, it's denatured ferritin becoming hemosiderin, which doesn't show up on the ferritin, doesn't show up on the ferritin assay. And to give the listeners an understanding of what we're talking about before we get to the testing, I want to make sure people really understand how serious this is. One atom of iron has four unpaired electrons. Mother Nature abhors unpaired electrons. That's how oxidative stress is created. Now, one molecule of ferritin has 10,000 unpaired electrons. And one molecule of hemosiderin has 100,000 unpaired electrons.
Sounds like some walking dynamite. And
and we're talking about one molecule. I don't know how many ferritins are in 1 milligram per deciliter. I have no idea. It's a frightening thought. And so the way I'd characterize it is we're using a intracellular storage protein that accounts for less than 10% of the iron in the human body. We're ignoring the hemoglobin pattern, which is 70% of the iron, but we're using that intracellular storage protein that gets secreted into the blood because of pathology, and we're determining people's iron status, wink, wink, on the basis of how much shows up in the blood. And so the way I characterize it is, when we're baking cookies, the oven temperature needs to be 350. You can't bake cookies if it's not that hot, right? So the equivalent, what doctors are doing, all practitioners, not just allopathic physicians, they're going over to the wall thermometer. They're seeing that it's 72, and they're theorizing what it is inside the oven, and they have no clue. And there is no measure of ferritin inside the cell. I mean, you can do it. It's a very complicated procedure, but doing a blood draw is liver pathology. It is not physiology. So in terms of testing that people would want to know, there's a website that I encourage people to go to. It's called requestatest.com. And there's actually a whole series. There's a menu bar on the left-hand side. You can go to all test packages. And when you go to all test packages, what pops up is a horizontal menu, A to Z, and you go to the letter M for Maggie, and there's a whole series of blood tests that we've developed through the Magnesium Advocacy Group, and there's one that's called the Full Monty Iron Panel, and it's looking at the magnesium inside the red blood cell. It's looking at zinc and copper, and this ceruloplasmin protein that has ferrooxidase function, sorry for all the big words. And then it's a whole series of markers that relate to iron. And we've done something very novel. We're not only measuring ferritin, we're measuring hemoglobin, because that's where 70% of the iron is found. And basically, I have ferritin there just to give deference to the listeners and all the people that think it's important. But what we do is surround it with a lot of information to interpret what's really going on with iron. Because iron is supposed to be like a square dance. It's in constant motion in the body. And you alluded to that in terms of what's in the blood is in the cell and back and forth in the tissue. And all of those handoffs need to be managed by enzyme function. And that enzyme function is called ferrooxidase. Can't get out of the cell. Can't get onto transferrin if you don't have ferrooxidase. And it's ridiculously important. And the fact that it's not tested is a condemnation of the system. And I'm not aware of an accurate or an easy accurate measure of iron in the tissue, but what we can do is interpolate what's there. But that blood test has helped a lot of people around the world begin to understand their true iron metabolism, because it really is it's a seesaw. And everyone's been on a seesaw. And what I want people to do is picture a five-year-old on one end of the seesaw and a sumo wrestler on the other end. And what do you think is going to happen when the sumo wrestler sits down on the seesaw? The little five-year-old is going to be holding on for dear life. Well, that's the part that gets measured in the blood. And a little five-year-old holding on to dear life is anemic compared to that sumo wrestler. Now, what the problem is that the fulcrum is not measured in the traditional blood test, except for the full Monty iron panel. And there is no measure for the sumo wrestler. But what happens is the system sees the five-year-old boy, he's anemic, they feed iron supplements or iron infusions to that five-year-old, and all the iron flows down the seesaw into the sumo wrestler, because it can't stay in the blood because there's no way to keep it in the blood. And that is what's happening, is the inflammation that you're referring to is all caused by iron. And there's a research team out of Japan called Nagamura in 2015 that determined and really was able to isolate the fact that labile, fancy word for free, but free iron in the cell activates what's called the danger sensor of the cell. And it has the initials NLRP3, Nathan, Lima, Romeo, Peter 3. And that is actually called the inflammasome. And that's the epicenter for inflammation. And it's activated by iron. And so all of this inflammation that people think comes from ours is actually coming from inside their iron toxic cells that don't get measured in a blood test, because the emphasis is on emia, which is Latin for blood. It's not on corpus, which is Latin for tissue. And so we're left in the dark, and that confusion about the seesaw and blood versus tissue is causing the poisoning of society on this planet on a scale that people have no idea about. And why do I say that? Because the World Health Organization tells us that iron anemia, iron deficiency anemia, is the greatest nutrient deficiency on the planet, affecting 2 billion people. And Rob, if you actually believe that, I've got both a bridge and a used BMW I'd love to sell you. And that is actually a great place for us maybe to stop for at this point, because it's my bewitching hour, but it gives the listeners a really powerful concept to think about, is could my doctor be wrong about my designation of anemia? And I would bet good money that they are wrong, and I can prove it with that blood test.
Yeah. I'm almost speechless. Thank you, so much, Morley. And we will definitely have you back for a part two, as there's so many other things I'd love to get into. And yes, would love to leave listeners kind of with that final thought of, recognizing we've all probably come across this concept, and we've been alluding to this throughout the entire podcast, the concept of oxidative stress, and oxygen and these free electrons and, quote unquote, the reactive oxygen species, these free radicals that carry these electrons and can, damage tissue, damage DNA. It's gotten quite a bit of press, and I feel people have quite a degree of fluency with this concept of, oxidative stress, and I need to eat more antioxidants from, foods, from plants, other nutrients to support this balance of, quelling the reactive oxygen species. And, I think even some people are probably familiar with as you mentioned, you know, iron itself, free iron, is very reactive and has been studied through, you know, the Fenton reaction is the perfect example of a mechanism of creating these sort of free radical species. And it's no figure that the body wants to regulate iron so, so intricately to leave nothing of it free to potentially create these reactive oxygen species, these free radicals, or as is also kind of common knowledge in the medicine world, understanding that a lot of bacteria and these microbial organisms have very amazing mechanisms of being able to utilize iron to, you know, propagate their existence. And so I sort of leave people with this concept of recognizing the potential downsides, right, of so much iron disrupting this oxidative stress balance. And we need to be very aware of perhaps these population level changes, these fortification type things that we're doing with iron and folate and different, you know, different measures, and potentially see there might be some downsides. And like you said, if I've been told by my doctor, because he's looked at my lab work or she's looked at my lab work and says that I'm anemic, maybe I should question and ask, well, why do you think so? What tells you that I'm anemic? And just ask the question. Be curious. Don't be, you know, you don't have to be, it doesn't have to come across as in judgmental way or, you know, you're wrong, but just be curious. Just ask that question. Well, what, why do you think I'm anemic? And get your lab test, get the results, because, you know, it's your body, and, you know, it's, you're the one who ultimately is going to be deciding, do I take this supplement? Do I eat this food? And so, you know, you can take that degree of ownership and realize that, you do have that power. And so, so yeah, I'd love to let you have the last word here before you have to run out the door. Like I said, telling people that we will have you back to have part two and perhaps part three of this discussion.
That'd be great. Well, let me leave people with just a couple key ideas to kind of bring this to closure in terms of what we're talking about. You alluded to copper deficiency anemia. It's a very important concept.
Yes.
I want the listeners to understand that the way we're wired as a species is if we don't have bioavailable copper to manage and regulate iron, and most people don't, there's a whole series of reasons why, but we don't have to go into that. But bioavailable copper is lost in our diet today. Well, the body is designed to store iron. And so what happens under those conditions, yes, you may be eating iron, but it's all getting stored in your liver. And that's where iron is stored first and foremost. So when copper is deficient, and I can assure you the vast majority of people in society today are copper deficient, it will lead to a buildup of iron in the tissue, which leaves a void of iron in the blood. So that's one connection. Second connection, they did a very interesting study on, they wanted to create a mouse model for hemochromatosis. People may know that that's the most severe form of iron overload that you can have in a human. It's called hemochromatosis. It's a very serious condition where iron is being stored all over the tissue of the body. Well, what they discovered is if they were to feed mice a magnesium deficient diet, which is what processed food is today. There's no minerals in food today.
Correct.
But feed mice a magnesium deficient diet and then followed up with an iron fortified diet, they would then become hemochromatosis. Mm. And what people need to understand is that they have been adding iron to our food system since Hitler was bombing London during the Second World War. And they added it to the wheat flour in England, Canada, the United States, and Australia. And it's been building ever since. And what the listeners also need to know is that there's 8 different forms of iron being added to our food system. And all 8 have been classified as carcinogens. So this idea that we need iron-fortified food is ludicrous, but when you have a magnesium deficient and or a copper deficient organism, you will have an iron problem that shows up in the tissue, but will not show in the blood. And I would encourage your listeners to be really mindful that anyone who has Lyme disease, any kind of chronic disorder, if they have cancer, if they have heart disease, if they have any kind of severe autoimmune condition, most of those people are anemic, not knowing that the iron is in their tissue driving the oxidative stress that you referred to earlier that is creating the chaos, the metabolic chaos that's preventing energy from being made, creating too much exhaust, and that's why they have this disease process. That's it in a nutshell, right there.
Yeah. It's the theories and the interconnections are endless. It's a fascinating rabbit hole to go down. And what I'm glad that you've gone down, and I'm following right after you, head over heels. Well, thank you again, Morley. Please go enjoy a wonderful evening, with your wife, and we will certainly be in touch, and listeners, please, you may have to listen to this a couple of times. I know I was just sitting here feeling like I was fluent with some of this knowledge and recognizing that I'm probably going to have to listen to this 2, 3, 4, 5 times to really let it sink in. So, be patient with it, but be present with it, because there's so much there to consume. And yes, please, Morley, we need you back for part 2 and part 3, because, I just got, I have more questions and would love to, to dig more into this, because I'm just sitting here looking at a picture of the heme molecule next to a picture of the chlorophyll molecule. And guess what? Is kind of the guess what's the really the only difference? I mean, there's some subtle differences, but guess what functionally is really the only difference between those two molecules?
It's a mineral in the center.
It's the mineral in the center,
and they have completely different properties. Different properties. So we will definitely have more conversations, Rob. I salute what you're doing. I think for someone at your age to be this aware and be this sensitive to these issues bodes well for society, and I hope you have a circle of peers around you that are really listening to what you're doing, because I think you are going to be a force to contend with, and I think it's going to be an important contribution to society to have folks like you to begin to raise these kinds of questions and think differently about what you were taught, that maybe there is, in fact, more to the story. And that's exactly what you're discovering, which I really commend you for.
Well,
that's great.
Well, thank you, Morley. Like I said, be curious and never think what you know is right. So until next time, be well, my friend.
Very good. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you for your presence and willingness to receive a new narrative, a passionate perspective, and perhaps a deeper sense of connection with our collective purpose. Please share this podcast with any and all that you believe will benefit from its intention to relieve one's doing and engage one's being. Please share your comments about the conversation on our podcast page and leave a review in iTunes so that the voices in this space can spread to all ears ready to receive it. Music credit goes to Dillingham for their song Vessel. Remain open, stay curious, and forever be love.
You walked on fire. In the know you tried.